Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, much of our listening audience is in Florida, and particularly in Central and South Florida, many people have orange and grapefruit trees in their yard. As a kid growing up in Miami, where nearly everyone had fruit trees in their backyard, including tangerines and mangoes and lemons and limes, you never bought citrus. You just picked it off a nearby tree. Driving north up the Florida Turnpike in the 1950s and 60s, which I can remember, before there were interstates, starting around Winter Haven, I think it was, there were miles and miles of orange groves, just undulating miles of beautiful groves, and every roadside stand sold oranges from Florida to tourists. But those days are mostly gone, and there are several reasons for that, starting with colder winters that shifted the freeze line farther and farther south as the years went by. Another has been development to accommodate the never-ending flood of people moving to Florida so that sprawling subdivisions replace those beautiful miles of groves. And another reason has been the increasing cost of agriculture in the U.S., which has led the big producers to shift to countries like Brazil. But a big reason also has been the wave after wave of insects and diseases that have decimated the citrus industry. And that's what we're going to talk about today. My guest is Dr. Michael Rogers, a University of Florida professor of entomology and the director of the Citrus Research and Education Center at UF's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, or IFAS, in Lake Alfred, Florida. He's an expert on this subject. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Court. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. I can remember reading once that early Spanish explorers sailing along the coastline off Cape Canaveral smelled orange blossoms and went ashore to find fresh fruit. I don't know if that's true or not, but were there oranges growing in Florida long before modern agriculture?
Well, oranges have been in Florida for quite a long time, but it was actually the Spanish who brought citrus to Florida. When they came on their long voyages across the ocean, they brought fruit with them, I guess as something to eat. And as history goes, those Spanish explorers gave citrus seed to the native people of this area who then planted it and started growing citrus for themselves. So history really traces back to those first Spanish explorers that came over and landed here in Florida.
So then, I mean, tell us a little more about the origins of oranges. That's kind of hard to say, the origins of oranges. I understand, you know, that was the very beginning of it. But once Americans of European descent beyond the Spanish, let's say, moved down into Florida, they began to cultivate citrus as an agricultural product. And this was also going on in other places around the country. So can you describe the background in general of the citrus industry in the U.S. and Florida's place in it?
Yeah. So, and I don't know all the history going back, you know, in the 14, 1500s of citrus, but the history picks up where most of us are familiar with in the early 1800s, not long after, you know, Florida became a U.S. territory. People began moving to Florida and they saw they could grow citrus here and it grew very well. And so I think the British may actually be attributed to starting some of the first commercial plantings of citrus in Florida in the early 1800s. And, you know, it was a small and developing industry at that time. They were learning to grow it. There was a lot of issues with temperature. Cold weather, obviously, is not a friend of citrus. So they had challenges, but they learned to grow citrus, and it really started to take off. And as people saw that you could grow citrus in Florida and make money, you started seeing people pour into the state of Florida because it was kind of the gold rush, if you will, for Florida. You would think gold rush California. Well, Florida, it was oranges. And so you could grow oranges and make a lot of money. And so that really kind of in the early 1800s is when the citrus industry really started to take off in Florida. But there were issues. And one of the main things has to do with transportation. You could grow the crop in Florida, but the markets were further north. And so really what limited the Florida citrus industry in its early history was the ability to ship that fruit out of state. So a lot of the production really stayed more local in the early part of the citrus industry. But when we get into the mid-1800s, late 1800s, the trains and rail lines moved into Florida. And really that transportation, the ability to move a product out of state further north up the East Coast is really what kind of helped the industry explode in Florida.
Yeah.
And so that's what really helped us see this industry grow. And then you get the late 1800s. We had another event that really shaped the industry. And those were some freeze events, major freeze events that occurred in North Florida where citrus primarily was being grown at the time.
Right.
We're talking the mid-1890s. And temperatures dropped so severely that it killed 90% or greater of the citrus trees growing in areas like Lake County and some of these other counties in north central Florida.
Wow.
And there were a lot of small towns that were built up in North Florida that the economy was based on citrus. And so as these groves are just decimated by freeze, people didn't have a livelihood anymore. And so the industry started moving south. And it went pretty much as far south as Polk County, which is where I'm located. And for people who don't know where Polk County is, if you took a dart and threw it at a map of Florida and it hit square in the center, north, south, east, west, that is Polk County. We're just south of Orlando, northeast of Tampa. Railroads had gotten into Polk County, so they had ways to move fruit out of the area. And we were a prime real estate area to be growing citrus at that time. And Polk County became really the center of the Florida citrus industry. And it's because of those freezes in the late 1890s. And it's really interesting because you had these small towns that really collapsed in North Florida and the population moved south to start growing citrus. And just as a personal note, the home that I live in now, the house, was built in 1899 by a doctor who moved from North Florida down to Lakeland, where I live in Polk County, because the town pretty much collapsed. And so all his patients, all the people he would care for were down here. So he moved down here and built a house. And we're now living in that 125-year-old house, which is a whole nother story. But everything shifted south. And so that's really why now you see the citrus industry focused so heavily in central and south Florida is because of the weather events in the late 1890s.
I hadn't realized that the development of Florida, the southward shift of development in Florida really was driven by the citrus industry, and in fact, in turn, driven by cold weather and freezes coming south. I hadn't realized they were tied so tightly together. I just figured it was a natural thing to keep going south because there was new open land there or whatever, but, you know, buy swampland for 5 cents an acre or whatever. But
yeah, absolutely. So, and I think, you know, really the railroads play a key role too there, because without the transportation, the citrus industry couldn't have really come south and had such a big impact on the economy of Florida.
Yeah, I mean, let's not get too much into the agricultural development of it, but I remember hunting and fishing as a kid west of the coast, west of the Atlantic coast, Fort Pierce, where I was then at that time, on the edges of the Everglades or what remained of it, and running occasionally into wild oranges, and they were very sour. I mean, you really didn't want to eat them. And those were, I guess, the ones that were the descendants of the ones that the Spanish had brought and that the Indians cultivated, but so they clearly were hybridized much beyond that by people who knew what they were doing, by plant scientists and so on, and agronomists to become the very sweet, delicious fruit that we know today. But how long a process was that, just briefly?
So there's been a lot of years of work breeding citrus. But what you see wild growing out, you know, throughout Florida, those are trees that have kind of volunteered or popped up where animals have spread seed. And so they've just popped up in areas. But when you take a seed from a citrus fruit, it's not necessarily going to give you a plant that produces fruit exactly like the fruit that it came from.
Yeah.
Because the variety doesn't hold true in the seed. So I'm not sure how best to explain that. Other than we've developed varieties. We typically grow citrus from making cuttings from one plant to another and propagate them through plant material, not by seed so much. And
yeah,
so
literally,
that way we have a more consistent variety of the same quality and what to expect.
I mean, literally, I remember in first grade, growing up in Miami again, this is how citrus-centric South Florida was. As part of our little science experiment, we would go out and strip the bark off of an orange tree out in the schoolyard and pack sphagnum moss around it and then wrap that in tinfoil and keep it wet. And then it would grow roots, and then we would cut it and plant it. So I guess it was grafting, you know, and that was something we were doing in first grade, which I doubt was being done in most parts of the country. But anyway, interesting. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And I talked in my intro about growing up in Miami with citrus everywhere. When I was very young, probably in the late 50s, I remember hearing about the Mediterranean fruit fly and a lot of alarm about what it would do to Florida's citrus industry. So we're talking here with Dr. Michael Rogers, who's an entomologist, and I guess we're getting into the center of your lane now. So was that the Mediterranean fruit fly the first big problem of that kind that the industry had faced? And what has been the history of attacks on the Florida citrus industry since then?
Well, Florida citrus has faced a lot of different insect pest issues and also diseases. Florida is one of those locations where if something comes in, it just tends to thrive because of our climate. So you can turn loose anything. You go to the Everglades, obviously see what's happening in the Everglades with pythons and things like that. But but the same is true with agriculture and citrus. And the Mediterranean fruit fly is one of those serious pests that fortunately is not established in Florida right now, because every time it has come into the state of Florida, there's been a program to eradicate or get rid of that pest. And I think probably one of the first recorded cases I remember off the top of my head was in the 1920s when Mediterranean fruit fly came in and it decimated. It infested, 75% of the state's crop or more. And what happens is those flies lay eggs in the fruit, and they basically cause the fruit to drop off the trees, become unusable. But it's a huge problem in terms of having the trees be productive. Also, if you're going to ship the fruit somewhere, you don't want to spread that pest around, because the Mediterranean fruit fly not only attacks citrus, but probably 200 different crops as well. It's not just for Florida. It's not just an issue about citrus. It's also all the other agriculture that exists in the state is at threat because of the Mediterranean fruit fly and other fruit fly pests that don't exist in Florida. So there's been a number of introductions of fruit flies where they've come into the state of Florida, and they've successfully been eradicated. Back in the 1920s, the eradication program was basically cut and burn. They cut down all the trees and burned them and started over. Nowadays, we have the Florida Department of Agriculture. When a fruit fly pest comes in, they can, with modern technology, they can actually, in large quarantine facilities, they will raise millions and millions of sterile males of those fruit flies. And they'll release them to mate with this invasive pest population that's starting to establish. And basically, they don't produce offspring or babies. You kind of have it into it. So we're really fortunate to have the state of Florida have such excellent facilities to prevent these pests from becoming established in Florida, because otherwise it would be very difficult for our agriculture, not just citrus, but all agriculture in the state of Florida.
Yeah, I can remember driving across country and going through different states, Texas to California, let's say, and being stopped at the border and asked, do you have any agricultural products with you? I mean, it's kind of like, almost at gunpoint practically, show me your oranges. And if you had anything like that, you had to hand them over, right? And that was all to prevent the transportation of pests. But would have been some other pests beyond flies that have attacked the Florida citrus industry since then. I remember hearing about canker, for example.
Yes, canker is a good example of probably one of the more important diseases that causes quarantines, or as you mentioned, like embargoes of fruit going out of the state of Florida. Canker is a bacterial disease that's spread by windblown rain. So when that bacteria lands on the fruit, it causes lesions and it'll cause the fruit to drop off the trees. And so other areas that don't have canker obviously don't want it. And really the only legal way to get fruit, fresh Florida citrus fruit out of the state, is it has to go through a cleanup process in a certified packing house. And so there's a lot of things that go into that. But the bottom line is we're guaranteeing if fruit is allowed to, it's going to be shipped out of state, we've made sure through a sanitation process that it's not going to be capable of spreading things like citrus canker to other industries in the U.S. like Texas or California or somewhere else. And also to our European or external international markets like the European Union or Japan, which also have citrus industries.
I'm sure that adds to the cost of the whole industry of production, probably quite a bit, handling all those threats. So let's talk in more detail about what I started to talk about in the introduction, which is citrus greening. And again, you're an entomologist, but you're the director of the Citrus Research and Education Center. And I imagine you know a bit about citrus greening, which is the current biggest scourge, I think, right?
Yes. We've been dealing with citrus greening disease here in Florida since we first found it in Florida in 2005. It had probably actually been here for a number of years before that. But citrus greening disease is a disease caused by a bacteria, and that bacteria is spread by an insect. So when I first came into Florida as an entomologist, I spent a lot of time working on the insect that spread citrus greening, which is called the Asian citrus psyllid. So I mentioned we found it for the first time in Florida in 2005. but the disease has been known. It originated in Asia, and it has been in places like India and China for more than a century. It could go back even to the 1700s on how it originated there, and over time has spread globally. More recently, it spread to the Western Hemisphere, you know, Brazil and Florida in 2004, 2005, probably because we're a more global society. We move around a lot more. We move a lot of things with us. And when we do that, so come the pests and diseases.
Right. Well, it's called citrus greening, but I've read about it only in the context of its impact on oranges. But does it affect all other kinds of citrus as well?
In general, it affects pretty much every type of citrus you would really want to grow. All oranges, it does affect your mandarins or your like tangerine varieties, grapefruit. Things that tend to be a little more tolerant, that can handle the disease better, are things like lemons and limes. They are affected, but to a lesser extent. But yeah, it really does affect pretty much every commercial citrus variety that we grow in Florida.
So what happens when a tree or an orange or whatever is affected by citrus greening? What actually happens to the fruit then?
Well, on diseased trees, the fruit will eventually become really small, and it just doesn't get to the large size. If you think of an orange maybe being close to the size of a baseball, eventually they'll be more like golf ball size.
Oh, gosh.
And of course, you know, in Florida, we're a orange juice state. 90% of our fruit goes to juice. Well, you don't get to squeeze much juice out of something the size of a golf ball. And what does come out, well, the juice machines couldn't handle it anyways, but if you did get the juice out, it wouldn't taste that great. And so we really see that over time, it's a slow death and a slow decline of the trees. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes years and years for the trees to decline due to disease. And, you know, and at the same time, the fruit quality is continually going down to where we don't have fruit that can be used. So it is a kind of a slow death, a slow decline. And that's what we've seen over the past almost, I guess, 20 years now in Florida. From 2005 to 2025, the Florida industry has gone from producing 225 million boxes of oranges in 2004 to, we're predicted, I think, 11.5 million boxes of oranges this year. So that's a huge impact, but it's taken a long time to get there because it's kind of a slow and steady death of these trees once they become infected.
Oh, great. How widespread is it geographically in Florida now?
Well, in Florida, it's pretty much everywhere. There is a resurgence of citrus production in the northern parts of the state, especially in the panhandle. Mostly up north, because of the colder weather, they're growing more mandarins and not so much round oranges or the sweet oranges that we grow for juice. But Satsuma mandarins are really popular in the panhandle. And they've done a good job of not having so much greening spread up there so far, just because they've had much smaller acreage and colder weather. But as the acreage and people start saying, hey, we can grow citrus up here again, they start growing more and more citrus, we're starting to see more and more citrus greening disease spread in that area. And also into South Georgia, they're starting to try and attempt to grow citrus in South Georgia. And so we're starting to see the disease spread up there. So really, for the most part, I think it's safe to say that all of the state of Florida is being affected to some extent by citrus greening disease, obviously much more so in the south and central part of the state.
Yeah, so it sounds like people are kind of opting for what I would consider to be more exotic species that may not be great for squeezing into orange juice that shows up on your grocery store shelf as an orange juice you can buy, like Florida Natural or Tropicana or whatever, to drop some names. But so it kind of changes the whole nature of the industry. And I guess it's a shift to try to find countermeasures to what's going on that's damaging the industry, but it gets pretty exotic. What steps has Florida's state government taken to eradicate these pests? You mentioned the early days of, I guess they were probably spraying pesticides and that kind of thing. And then you mentioned developing sterile males for insects and so on. But what other kinds of things have been done, just kind of briefly, and how effective have they been?
Well, if we're talking about citrus greening disease, it's a little different than all the other problems that we've dealt with in the past. You know, we mentioned fruit flies and sterile male release. With citrus canker disease, that was an eradication program where they came in and it would cut and burn trees to prevent the spread of canker. But in the case of citrus greening disease, you've got an insect that's moving this bacteria around. And what happens is when the insect first feeds on the tree, when it puts that bacteria in the tree, you don't see symptoms for maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 years, depending on the tree size. And so what we've had when the disease was first found in Florida, when symptoms started showing up on trees, those trees had already been infected for maybe 4 or 5 years or longer. Mm-hmm. And during that time of no symptoms available to, you know, we didn't identify there was a problem, this disease was spreading silently and unknown throughout the state.
Wow.
So by the time we found that we had this disease, it was already widespread. And it really prevented us from doing anything to try to eradicate the disease because it had just gotten spread too far too fast. And when those symptoms did start showing up, the first symptoms on the trees mimic nutrient deficiencies, like you've done a poor job of fertilizing the trees. So that just really confuses things even more. So it was a situation where, you know, the state of Florida didn't have a chance to get ahead of this before we found it because it had already spread so far so fast. And that is why this disease, citrus greening, is known as the worst disease of citrus worldwide. It is what limits citrus production in every other country in the world because it is so difficult to manage, to identify, and it's just the disease you don't want to have.
Is there any cure at all?
There's not a cure at this time for the disease. Really, what we have to do is we have to treat the symptoms, essentially. Hmm. So one of the things that we've learned about the disease since it's been here in Florida, and it's interesting because this wasn't known for the 100-plus years it's been in Asia. But when that bacteria gets into the tree, you know, the insect feeds on the leaf of the tree, it has needle-like mouthparts. It pumps that bacteria into the leaf, and then it goes down to the root system of the tree. And what happens is the first real big effect on the tree is it starts killing off the root system. And so if you've ever pulled up a plant in the garden or even a tree, you'll notice a lot of the roots are really fine, almost like hairs.
Sure.
And those hairy roots are what take up water and nutrients. You have the big, large diameter roots that are structural roots that hold the tree up. Mm-hmm. But this disease is killing off, you know, 30, 40, 50% of those hairy roots that take up water and nutrients before you see any above ground symptoms. And so then what happens is those above ground symptoms are a result of the trees not able to function properly, to move water and nutrients and other, you know, it really limits other biological processes inside the tree.
Right.
So what we've done, growers are doing to a limited extent right now is trying to improve the health of these diseased trees, understanding that, you know, what effect, how this disease is affecting the tree. So for example, we know that the root system is not going to be very effective in taking up nutrients, fertilizer, or water. So instead of watering, you know, once a week or twice a week, fertilizing 3 times a year, what they do is they do smaller doses of irrigation of water or smaller doses of fertilizer more frequently. You know, just putting out what the root system can take up at that time, but doing it more frequently so the plants don't starve to death. So it's really spoon feeding these trees to keep them alive. We're not putting out more water or more fertilizer. We're just doing smaller doses more frequently. And that's kind of the foundation of the program that growers are using to keep the trees alive and, I say, productive. We'll say somewhat productive, relatively speaking, to where we used to be. So that's kind of the starting point of managing this disease. And then there's other things that we're doing, looking at ways to improve the hormonal balance in the trees that help it retain fruit and things that we can apply to the trees to try to control the bacteria. So there's a lot of other things going on, but the problem is all this costs money. It's not as cheap or as easy to grow citrus as it was, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's where the growers are having the biggest challenge. Is I think most growers have a good idea. Here's what I need to do to keep these trees alive, but the cost to do so, especially, you know, post COVID with all the supply chain disruptions and the cost of everything's cost have gone up, and it's just not affordable or economical for many growers to stay in business when the yields are low, but the cost have more than doubled.
Yeah, it's always tough to be a farmer, no matter what you're growing. I think everything is against you, and you have to struggle constantly. So I think that the work you guys are doing in agricultural sciences at IFAS is probably very useful. But again, it's more labor intensive. The kind of countermeasures you're describing just take more people, more time, and that costs money. So you said also that citrus greening has spread to other countries. So, I mean, where does orange juice come from now if it's that restricted here?
Well, most of the orange juice, at least for the U.S., is going to come from Florida, but it's also probably going to be blended with juice from Brazil, Mexico, Belize, maybe some other areas. But they all are dealing with citrus greening as well. Brazil just tends to have a larger acreage of citrus in production right now than Florida does. And so so a lot of the processors, you know, the juice is still processed here in Florida, but we are having to supplement what's produced in Florida with juice from other countries right now.
Yeah, I read an article, and it's really what prompted me to contact you and to do a show on this topic, that orange juice is progressively just being priced out of the market and will become like a luxury product that you can't have every morning a glass of orange juice like, you know, most of us have had our entire lives. It's like a routine thing, but it may become something that's a luxury. So do you think that's a prospect? And, you know, and what other factors will affect the market? I mean, like inflation and demographics and the kind of people who want to drink orange juice. I mean, is it likely that orange juice will become a rare, more luxury product in the future than it always has been?
Well, of course, I hope not.
Yeah, right.
but you know, it is one of those things that even in the time that I've been in Florida, I've been in Florida since 2004, and we've seen increases and decreases in demand. There's lots of things that affect the price of orange juice and the supply, and things like different diet fads that are going on in the U.S. Sometimes it'll be, oh, we're low carb. You can't, you know, drink, you know, have the sugar, even though it's natural sugar. There's a lot of things that affect that, but I do think right now with the high prices that we're seeing, we have such low quantity of juice in reserves that the prices are pretty high. It is costing more to produce that. And my hope is that over time, as we find ways to better manage this disease, develop better solutions to the disease, our supplies will go up, cost will come down for the producers, which will also result in lower prices for the consumers. So there's a lot that has to happen there so we can get back to that place we want to be. But I'm very optimistic that in the future, we're going to be able to make some improvements that will help increase that supply and hopefully drop those prices so it will remain a staple of everybody's refrigerator.
Okay, well, good. I like the optimistic sound of that because, as I said, the article I read was very pessimistic about that. So I'm glad to hear that that you have a brighter view of it and you're closer to it than the author of that article probably was. So so I just want to say that to find out more about what Michael's center, the IFAS Center, does and about all the things we've been talking about, the simplest way to do it is just Google IFAS, I-F-A-S, IFAS Citrus Research and Education Center, and you'll find their website and you can probe around there and find out, you know, the history of fruit and the history of these different diseases and the kind of research they're doing and anything you might want to know. So, Dr. Michael Rogers, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety today.
Thanks again, Court.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.